try to make smiles to bring sight to the blind man and sound to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters above and not like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator, and survivalist. Spitting heaven's fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom." And with all that, getting an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the home page, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream or the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted by myself or Brother Richard. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcast of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times and share with your friends. Also check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace in partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things being placed on the marketplace all the time. African language classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us in conversation this evening, Doctor of Clinical Psychology and spiritual life coach Dr. Jeff Menzi will be with us in conversation this evening. An African origin of Freemasonry is one of the topics that we'll be talking about with our special guest, Dr. Jeff Menzi. And we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors. If I can get this commercial queued up properly here. Boy, it's always something to live radio. But we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. You know, we're starting to count down to the cold weather. And again, for Time for Awakening, Brother Richard is one of them who has a deep aversion to the cold. And as winter comes, and I've been born in the North, raised in the North, experienced all of my life mostly in the North, I still have an African soul and a need for a climate where it's warm and temporal, if that's the right word.
Yeah, well, you better stay in the house and turn the heat up.
But other than that, it's been a real productive week, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Dr. McKenzie, and I really appreciate him, on a short notice being able to get with us. But I heard him over last week, I believe it was, and it's just something that struck that he was speaking on made me want to share. And I didn't know, Elliot, that he was already a guest on Time for Awakening, so that was new to me. But to share, just for my own edification and hopefully for the Time for Awakening audience, learning curve of just dealing with our mind and how symbols informs our mind and how ancient symbol system making and what it has done for Africans' mental development, especially in this time, since we're talking about 1619 to 2019.
It's good to be able to go into these subjects. Last week, we had an interesting conversation with documentary filmmaker Jeremiah Kamara in reference to the Black church. Today, this is an interesting subject because, Richard, when our ancestors came here and our people became mentally destroyed under European domination, we were grasping for straws at vestiges of our parts of our culture, grabbing at other people's culture. And a lot of times we still find ourselves doing that. This data just passed a couple of days ago, which is a European holiday. They basically cherish some of the things that their people did back in Europe. This holiday of Halloween, they really consider that a holiday if you talk to Europeans. And it really turns my stomach when I see our people really getting immersed and involved in that and involving their children, which is even worse. That just shows me that our people really need some mental rehabilitation, really need to know about the cultural values, the cultural codes of conduct, the mores of our ancestors. It really needs to be reestablished among our people. Our guests have done some research, and which will be a major part of the topic tonight on the African origin of Freemasonry. I want to bring our guest in, Dr. Jeff Menzie. If I can get this queued up here. Dr. Menzie, how are you, sir?
Doing pretty good. How you been?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's been years since you've been on, about maybe 4 or 5 years, Dr. Menzie. I don't know whether you remember. We were on terrestrial radio at the time, and we brought you on.
It's been a while, man. How you been?
Oh, I'm doing great. We're still hanging in there trying to do what we do. And I see that you've been continuing to do what you do. I've been following a lot of the things you've been doing, hearing you when you come on call, and it's good to have you back on the program.
Hey, yeah, I appreciate the invitation, man.
Dr. Menzie, I've seen that you've written several books since the last that you were on with us, and I see that several of your titles are dealing with symbolisms and the origin of Freemasonry. Why did you start writing? Because I see you got about 4 publications, or maybe more, dealing with that.
Yeah.
Why did you start writing those particular books?
Yeah, I've got a total of 9 books at this point. 9 books and 2 decks of playing cards and 2 decks of mind training cards that I've developed, one with my daughter. I think when we last talked, man, I might have had Symbolically Speaking and the one on J.A. Rogers' gun. But the reason why I published the book that you're referencing now, which is Symbolically Speaking, African Lodge Number 1, The Context, is because I felt that it was necessary for us to get a deeper and more accurate understanding of what Freemasonry definitely is and what it can also be and how it relates to African spirituality. I know a lot of people have an understanding of Freemasonry that makes it seem like it's anything but something that we should be involved in that causes African people. And so, I just took that bold step out there to just kind of proclaim that, no, it's directly related to our spiritual systems. And here's how it is. And so that was really my motivating force behind it.
Richard? Brother Richard?
Oh, excuse me. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
It's interesting, Dr. Menzies, because and once I heard you on the Prince Hall think tank, I was thinking, just because of Prince Hall, and by me being, I'm a tour guide at the African American Museum, so that period and Philadelphia, Masonic origin is tied to Prince Hall in such an early period. And I'm always amazed of our that historic institutional legacy. But I want to back, if you mind, because the thing that struck me so much in your work is the whole question about symbolism and symbols and African spirituality and tracing it back to ancient African, I'm going to call it Moses thoughts. And that's really my first question for you. Do you see that symbols, especially symbols that African creators, say in ancient Kemet or as some call Egypt, were to assist in our modes of thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, symbols are, symbols are something that come with the universe. Everything is symbolic, meaning that everything that you can see, every tangible thing represents something else. And can be made to represent other things, almost infinite representation. By symbols being such an ancient tool, an ancient aspect of creation, its presence and its conscious and intentional use will actually stimulate other forms of thinking, other aspects of your mind, which then, based on that stimulation, then gives you different capabilities, different qualities to your own cognition. It gives you different powers, if you will. And so, yeah, man, symbols were and continue to be used to enhance cognition. But they can also be used to subtly feed information and directives to people who aren't aware of their presence. And so it's just a tool. How the person chooses to use it pretty much determines the outcome of its use.
And the reason I wanted to, get that, the point of is something that Dr. Obadeli Gambon, when he was on one time with us, he made this reference of knowledge production and the importance of us in dealing with our knowledge production. And, again, when we look at the record that we have in ancient Kemet, we know we have something that deals with knowledge production from the not only from the point of the universal ideal of man, but also the institutional building, the engineering, and that men can do. And so the reason why I bring that up because in that 19th century when they were creating institutions, one thing was to create a new identity, and the other thing that your book, African Lodge Number One. Just the title brought out was the identity creation of African. Was that a conscious and deliberate reality for Prince Hall or those men who felt that they needed to, being in this hostile environment, create an identity, which is a symbol in and of itself, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so you're asking if the use of the word African?
African, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as I've been able to understand, is that yes, it was absolutely intentionally done. I mean, because they could name themselves all kinds of things. Now, you have people explaining the intentional use of the word African when describing their version of Freemasonry as being that's just what we called ourselves back then, meaning that there was nothing especially conscious about that move. And, with that, the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopalian Church, for me, for those institutions, AME Church actually growing out of Prince Hall Freemasonry to, a large degree, when you see that intentional use, and then you also see what those organizations did and have done and continue to do, I can't help but to say that, yeah, these brothers knew what they were doing. And I personally feel like it was a seed being planted for those, you know, because, you know, anybody who's watching cycles, you know, like Benjamin Banner could watch the stars, any of our astrologers out there understand that, you know, things happen in cycles. And so there's a, you know, there's feast and there's family, you know, there's awake and there's slumber. And, you know, all nations, institutional organizations go through their high and low points. And so part of what I, you know, have reasoned with is the notion that the word African was used early on as kind of a seed to be planted. And now when we're starting to, quote unquote, wake back up, we can go back to our history and now understand, like, whoa, you know, for this whole Freemasonry thing, there might be another place for us to seek our light. And that place is going to be within the African worldview and African spirituality.
And the thing that, you know, what you, when you say that, because the other, and I don't know if I'm even just speaking symbols to try to extract something, because I'm looking at us from, as you say, in the cycles of our institutional building. And now, you know, trying to truly be centered in our own African reality, as some said in 19th century, even our own, I mean, I think it was, you know, Alexander Cromwell was saying, in our own civilizational framework, you know, and commit as a record that is there, a symbolic record that is there, keeps us, we can't deny that, even though it was trying to be erased from us. But I erase in the sense of making our connection historically and symbolically as a part of that continuum. I noticed another book you did was about Nate Rogers. And I want, and you know, and with Dumbing Down, you know, I guess that was Carter Woodson. So you were you trying to show that we've always kind of been in search of our African identity as a conscious, deliberate thing, consciously and unconsciously?
Yeah, what I would say is that up until a certain point, we were fighting to hold on to it. Once it was finally wrestled from our mental grip and our grasp, then it's been a fight to reclaim it. You know, that's kind of looking at it on a timeline. And so I would just say early on, it was an attempt to hold on to it, to continue to embrace it. When I was doing the research for African, symbolically speaking, I came across an article from the Scottish Masonic Temple, their library. And it was just talking about this guy, this European dude was over in East Africa, down in Ethiopia and Sudan area. And he came across these African brothers who he said, basically he was saying he gave a Masonic grip and the guy had the same exact grip. And he said that, you know, certain of their language, you know, mimicked what is mimicked in the Masonic lodge that he was attending in Europe. And he was kind of perplexed by that, saying that, you know, there's no way that this African dude has been to any of our lodges in Europe. And I've definitely never been a part of their particular initiation rites. You know, and us being who we are, they end up initiating this dude. And what he found was that a lot of what he went through with these African brothers is exactly similar to what he goes through in his Scottish lodge. And so there are people who know, you know, but it's those of us that try to hold on to it, and it's those of us who's trying to reclaim it. And it's also those of us trying to wake up those of us that don't have a clue about it. I do see it as a very intentional move, and that is very necessary.
And one of the intentional moves, you know, in that, I think it was around somewhere around in the 50s when I don't have the exact date, but Martin Delaney, who was, you know, also a Masonic brother, really tried to, and that's the 1850s, and I'm going to jump back in a minute, but he really tried to do, from a research base, make the correlation for us. And the reason why I'm kind of emphasizing this, because I think when you say about the symbolic thing, I'm looking at organizational building, right? We cannot see any better organizational builders than those who come out of ancient Kemet at that period that we have record of. Not saying that other African civilizations didn't, but there is record of how they did it and what they did. And the knowledge development that was required for them to do it. Did you explore Delaney to any degree as you were developing, you know, your work, or as you through, you know, your journey, your travel?
Yeah, I mean, I've been familiar with Mark Delaney from the historical perspective, and then also knowing that he was a Press Hall Freemason. So I was well aware of him. I included actually one of his addresses, and actually in Symbolically Speaking as an appendix, as one of the appendices. He's actually there, his speech that he gave pertaining to, you know, the African origins of Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm. And that's like in the 1850s, and I kind of try to read David Walker's appeal, but it seems that even David Walker tied. Again, I'm just want the awakening audience to recognize that, and also, if y'all don't mind, Elliot and you, Dr. Menzi, I'm being arrogant too, because I would like the Masonic brothers to recognize also that I'm always astonished when I have to do the history of Black Philadelphia and have to deal with, you know, I think it is African Lodge number one, Philadelphia, Philadelphia was that Absalon Jones became the Grand Master of the Lodge. But the importance of that institution towards the development of African people, and I'm going to say liberation for African people in that hostile moment. That was a deliberate, as you say, institution. And the question comes like how deliberate we are in using our historical institutions to deal with institutions past and present. So David Walker was speaking and made that connection of Africans tying to be tied to their civilization of Kemet. So I'm asking, how did you weave his speech into this thinking of being symbolic knowledge production, if you did at all?
Yeah. So yeah, I actually didn't. I did include it just as a very important document. But I don't make any reference to it throughout the text, but what I do when I do bring up somebody like Martin Delaney, you know, it's just to kind of show that, you know, that there was some very, very revolutionary spirits in the early Prince Hall Freemasonry. And, you know, like you were saying, the hostilities that those early brothers were facing. I mean, you know, you're talking about when a large number of Africans were still on plantations in this nation, you know, and here you got brothers who are not only reclaiming, you know, I say reclaiming, you know, their rights as Masons, but also pushing against some of the most powerful people in this nation in order to make it happen. And when I look at it from that perspective, it makes me know that they knew and understood that there was something very, very, very valuable being held within this institution. And because symbols are timeless, you know, and symbols are easy to use, right? He's talking like the Adinkra symbol. You know, if we talk about the Jenny Ami, you know, you can do a whole book on that one symbol. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's reduced down to one image, all that vast knowledge. And so I think that our elders, our founding 15 is what I like to call them, the Immortal 15. When you look at what they were doing, and you look at how they did it and the odds that they were doing it against, you know, it to me, it speaks volumes of the understanding of the value within this institution, which is strongly based on its symbolism.
And because, you know, Elliot, because we're, you know, I perceive we're in another, you know, as you say, Dr. Menzi, you know, cycles, we're in another hostile moment. I perceive that, you know, this, the need for especially men, African men, to, you know, as I say, stand up and you know, do what we have to do, becomes so critical in this time. But the question that comes to my mind, and it may be unfair, Dr. Menzi, but do you think that the institution understand the legacy, the symbolic legacy, that really becomes the link? You know, Prince Hall Masonry, if we understand what the connection, it is the link between the old and the new African world. Do you think the institution really symbolically, I mean, understands its symbolic, what's that, stewardship in relationship to that ancient civilization in our present condition?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I don't know the institution as a whole, but definitely there are those within the organization that are major players within the institution that recognize that to various degrees. You know, some people know it without question. Some people are, you know, learning it. Some people are still debating whether it's reality. And you have some that are just flat out denying it. You know, so, you know, it runs the gamut. You have so many people within the organization and for so many different reasons with different perspectives and orientations. So, you know, it varies. What I do find interesting, though, is like right there, you know, you all are in Philly, right?
Yeah.
You know, right there in Philly, the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania, you know, downtown, they have an entire room called the Egypt Room. And the story behind that room is that this is the White Masonic Lodge. The story behind that room is that it was the first one that they completed in that vast building. And not only that, but they sent somebody over to Egypt, you know, to study how the lodge room is laid out over there in order that they can mimic it as closely as possible right there in Pennsylvania. And I include pictures of that lodge in symbolically speaking. I actually took a trip up there to Philly. And, you know, they unlocked the room for me and allowed me to, you know, walk around the room and have however much time I wanted in there to take these pictures. And, you know, we have certain lodges here in the D.C. area, white lodges that also boast of Egyptian Kemetic symbolism. And so what I often say is that we, as descendants of the African Lodge, tend to push back more against that notion than the European Mason.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's the, you know, that's why when I seen the dumbing down and the reference to miseducation of the Negro, it became, you know, you doing that work for me made some kind of connection, because I kind of hear that too, and I'm kind of wondering, you know, because you raised another point early on. You said about the spiritual connection of symbols, so it isn't just in relationship to the knowledge that we get in relationship to knowing, but there is a what I guess you would call it, a metaphysical connection that the symbols, when we engage in them, if we believe that they are real communicating, you know, systems, that makes us tied to our ancestors. Am I off by saying it that way, or is it a better way for me to say that in relationship to the what the symbols and a spiritual connection to our ancestors as far as in being able to read into them?
So, yeah, I agree that the symbol does more than just transfer information. It does that as well. But it's far from just a physically based or cognitively based tool. You have symbols used in almost all spiritual systems. And so, like, for example, when you look at like Ifa divination, or if you look at the I Ching divination system, or if you look at the Medu Neter oracle that Ra Nefer-Amen developed, all you find are symbols within each one of those different high oracle systems. And so that to me, demonstrates the spiritual nature of the symbol itself. But again, people use symbols on so many different levels. It just depends on the one operating and handling the tool. Like, for example, you got some people who know how to use a table saw, and then you got people that are mastered the use of the table saw. And I see it the same way. You have people that who know how to use symbols, people who are constantly using them. But regardless of all of that, it definitely also has a spiritual impact. If you look at, for example, logos for companies, you know, those are often highly developed symbols, especially those brands that have longevity to them, to the point to where you don't even have to be in the physical presence of the actual product. You can see the symbol and your body can respond as if you are in the presence of the product. Mm. You know, and so that's how powerful symbols are. When we dream, you know, those are all symbols. The entire dream is symbolic, even if there are some literal messages in there. It's a total symbolic experience that actually can shift your waking state. You know, so I mean, just to be direct, yes, I agree with you about symbolism being more than just information based, but it's also dealing with spirituality.
You know, Elliot, I don't know how you see and where we're going as far as in understanding this, but it just makes sense when we're talking about dealing with modes of thinking to deal with our liberation. And what comes to mind is in Haiti, it was understood that Bukman, you know, was actually a part of a ceremony before the incursion of, I mean, even before Toussaint, but Bukman was an African ceremony that were dealing with the not only just symbols as far as you say, Dr. Menzi, divination, but even in the dance performances to be able to inspire the power that we needed in order to deal with different in that sense, it was a military campaign. So I'm really open to how do we utilize this in the now? And I guess that's the question for you. Are our collective mind more ripe now as you see it? And I know that might be opinion more than a, you know, scholarly position, but is our collective mind more rightly positioned to accept our historical continuity of the systems that were given and the spiritual relationship that they provide us in this present environment, in your opinion?
And more so now than when?
Than, say, the 19th century or the 18th century when Prince Hall Masonry came into existence.
Now, I don't think that minds are more ripe now. I think that technology has shifted the transmission, you know, and access that people have to information. But I wouldn't say that minds are more ripe now. I can't make that statement. If anything, I feel like it's going to be the same percentage of open minds. It's going to be the same percentage across time. You know what I mean? I think that percentage holds pretty steady. I think it holds pretty steady. But what we do have right now is access, you know. So and we have not only access to information and resources, but we have access to each other now on a more tangible level. If you read some of the old literature and some of the old spiritual writings, you know, brothers used to meet and, you know, an ancient form of the World Wide Web where, you know, they would astral travel, you know, collect with each other and hold a meeting, exchange information, go through certain rites, and then, you know, wake up in the morning back in their bodies. You know, you got documentation of that. So, you know, we've always had our means of communicating with each other. But just to be direct on your question, man, I would have to say that the percentage is probably very similar to what it's always been.
Do you see anything, Elliot? What do you think? Do you think that in this time that we're more mentally more ripe for being connected with our ancient knowledge-based symbol systems as you understand it or see it?
Well, you know what? This is what we'll do. I'm going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I'm going to answer that question and hopefully get other people involved. And you can get involved by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with Dr. of Clinical Psychology and Spiritual Life Coach, Dr. Jeff Menzi, the African origin of Freemasonry, are some of the topics we'll be discussing this evening. And again, we're going to take a brief break, and you can get involved right after the break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. And with this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people are righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that wants justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities, take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception.
And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Alps had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
If we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and it's 8:50 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation this evening with Doctor of Clinical Psychology, Spiritual Life Coach, Dr. Jeff Menzi. The conversation tonight centers around the African origin of Freemasonry. Dr. Menzi? Dr. Menzi, you still
there? Yes, sir.
Oh, okay, good. Before we took a break, Richard asked me my feelings on, and repeat that, Richard, because I want to get that right.
Whether we are, you know, the amount of people that are prepared mentally for, even if we use the term African liberation, based off of having, as Dr. Menzi said, having the amount of access to the knowledge base, do you see that it's, We're accessing it. I mean, I see.
Well, let me say something. I don't feel as though that we're accessing it. And in fact, I think that the men that you talked about during that period of the formation of the African Lodge had more understanding on what they were dealing with than our people now. It seems as though our people have become more subservient to white culture and white domination. Our people have been more assimilated to white culture and white domination. Some of those people back then, and we've read some of the old documents, Richard, they wanted to be separate from Europeans. They had the understanding that they would never be accepted by Europeans. I think now our people have a misconception of who they're dealing with, a percentage of our people. How large a percentage, I don't know. I do know this, that the work that Dr. Menzi is doing to enlighten people that are among that social order is excellent. But I know, just like he acknowledged on the program, that he's getting pushback. Dr. Menzi, as a clinical psychologist, I want you to put that, I want to travel down that path a little bit. That pushback. Now, you said it's not coming from Europeans, and I know clearly why. But the pushback by our people to understand, and it's not like you're bringing some type of knowledge that nobody ever heard, that you're bringing it, is something that you came up with. a lot of this knowledge that you said, we have more access to now. The pushback, the psychological or just out in your face, the overt pushback, what do you think that is?
Well, I think it's different people for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Not all black people pushing back and not all Europeans embracing. You get your mix of both. But, you know, what I find is that sometimes it's just that we don't know. And when a person believes that they already know something and some information comes along that challenges, this is the other thing, because, you know, saying you're using the word knowledge, and I would use the word information. You know, the people are more informed now, but I don't necessarily say the people are more knowledgeable, meaning that, you know, people have access to the information.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that they have a command of the information or that they have anything other than stored these bytes of data that they can be regurgitated on command. We oftentimes will misunderstand or mistake information being informed for being knowledgeable. And, you know, I just draw a clear distinction there.
Okay.
But when you look at, you know, so when people are informed and have been informed in a certain way and have functioned based on this information, when information comes along, it's going to alter that. It literally has to challenge their entire perspective of themselves and reality. And any healthy being, first reaction to that is going to be self-preservation, meaning maintain what I've been thinking is the truth. It takes more force to push past something that you think you know in order to embrace something that's going to challenge what you think you already know. And unfortunately, a lot of people aren't exercising that muscle these days. But, you know, I think that the pushback is because, again, it challenges the existing beliefs. Sometimes the pushback is just pure denial, like meaning a person knows what you're saying could be true, and they're going to deny it anyway, because to accept it again means that they have to stop living a lie. Then you got the people who, you know, who reject it because they just really, really think that it's wrong. They really, really think that it's incorrect. And, you know, we've been thoroughly trained to believe the things that we believe these days. You know, we've been conditioned to believe what we believe, and we've been conditioned to value what we value. And it's unfortunate, but we value a European perspective more so than the African perspective these days.
Mm-hmm.
And so when somebody's coming with an African perspective about whatever topic, you know, they come up with these words, you know, woke and, you know, hoteps and all of that nonsense. You know, they start pushing that stuff to make people less likely to go deeper into that type of knowledge. You know, so, I mean, it's a heck of a system. You know, Mr. Fuller, Neely Fuller Jr. and Dr. Weldon, you know, they said it best, man. It's a system of racism and white supremacy, and it's active in all nine areas of people activity, including education. And that's where you're going to find a lot of these values being instilled. That's where you're going to find the longevity of the misinformation. And not only that, but you're going to find a system of reward and punishment within education. That's when people are rewarded for regurgitating the falsehood and punished for regurgitating the truth, because they don't match what the correct answer is on that particular test at that time.
Does that mean we have to, and I'm thinking in two ways, does that mean we have to all go through individual clinical therapy, or is it a way that, especially from an organizational development perspective, does that mean that we have to have some mechanism within our organizations to assist people to deal with that? Not just the pushback, but just identifying the information or the values we have compared to the values we should have. That's in our both sides. Does that mean we have to deliberately put something in place to address what y'all are talking about?
I'd say absolutely, because we're intentionally put in the place that we're currently in, and so it's going to take an intentional movement to get out of it. And one thing that people misunderstand is the nature of the situation. And I find a lot of people that put on economics, you know, put it on miseducation, but keep it on the very surface level. My understanding is that the current situation is spiritually based, you know, and so not only do we have to have a mechanism within our institutional organization, but that mechanism should be some type of spiritual cultivation process. And, you know, I don't care what the organization is, which African liberation movement we're talking about, there should be a functional spiritual science within that organization, to where you have somebody who knows how to use the various divination tools. You have several people who do. You know, you have people who understand the spirituality of our ancestors, and to the point that, and I would dare say that the majority of people should, but there should definitely be some people that are in there that are masterful, and it's their way of life, so that they become that level of resource to the rest of the organization. You know, you can't lose having somebody who knows how to divine in your organization, man. I mean, you could be UNIA, and if you got diviners, and you have high priests in the Yoruba or the Ifa tradition, or high priests in the Kemetic order, you know, within your organization, you know, it can only benefit you all to be able to make ebo, make sacrifices, do divinations about things, situations, you know, using your spiritual tools to make manifest and all those types of things. And so I would say, you know, so I agree, yes, we do have to have mechanisms in place. And I'm taking it a step further and saying those mechanisms should be spiritual in nature, because that's what's happening. We're suffering from a spiritual assault.
Mm. You're making me have to go down two areas, Elliot. I don't know if I want to take Brother Menzi down there, because the question that comes to my mind is that when we look at, and I'm not looking at conversion, just looking at the institutions as we move into the future, say, well, go to I'm gonna use the church first. Do you think that in church structures amongst the denominations, as they're presently organized, do they have that component that addresses that this, as you see it from a clinical psychologist perspective? Is that mechanism there?
I would say the mechanism is definitely there. Is it being utilized as such? In most cases, no.
Mm. And the same thing would be now the lodge. And the thing that I always say, and I say to people when I do on, and I think that's mentioned earlier, you know, the Masonic Lodge is as old, and I think you even make reference that it may even be older than Black churches as a organized Black institution formulated in North America specifically. And when I talk to especially some in Pennsylvania, you know, the historians, you know, just to get some understanding of the history, and ask, well, what is the function of it? And they say to make man upright. So when we're talking from a psychological perspective, as we're have an institution that has such a history, the same question has to be asked. Does that mechanism to deal with this spiritual assault truly exist within the structure? Or is it something that, you know, at some point that it is going on to be implemented? And I don't want into the details of it, but just the understanding that we have these historical institutions that really assist, but may have some weaknesses that we need to be aware of.
Yes, if I understand you correctly, you're asking me, do I think that those same tools exist within the organization? And I would give the exact same answer. It definitely exists, but the masses aren't using it as such.
Okay.
You know, because one of my statements is that, you know, we've been given back, you know, our institution, but we weren't necessarily shown how to use it when we received it.
Mm.
You know?
Mm. So I kind of, you know, just so let me ask you this. As you were dealing with African Lodge number one, how did you lay it out? So for those, you know, we want everyone to be able to go purchase it and get the insight that you put in it. How did you lay that out? Was it historical or psychological, or dealing with the symbols from a historical perspective?
Yeah, so it's a combination of all of that. So the foreword to the book is actually written by past master Alton G. Rowntree. He's one of the preeminent historians within Prince Hall Freemasonry. I always tease him. The books that he writes encyclopedias and phone books. You know, that's how big his books are. Mm-hmm. And he comes purely from a historical perspective. You know, he's one of the coldest historians as far as Prince Hall Freemasonry is concerned. Encyclopedic command, you know. And so he wrote the foreword, which is a brief history on Prince Hall Freemasonry. So that's the historical aspect. And then what I do is I get into some of the symbolic perspectives, the philosophical understandings, you know, interwoven with some historical dialogue. And so you get a lot of, and, you know, definitely because I'm talking about initiation and rites of passage within the book, I'm also dealing with it psychologically. I do a correlation. I have a chart in the book where I correlate between rites of passage programs and Freemasonic initiation, just to show how, you know, how the two consist of the same characteristics, qualities, and traits, and how it benefits us to actually see it as such, as a rites of passage program, as a spiritual initiation process, you know, because then that it broadens our perspective and understanding of the potential of what it is that we are involved in. And then I deal with George Grandmaster James, you know, George G.M. James, The Stolen Legacy. In my chapter, I call it Reclaiming Our Stolen Legacy. And I'm just talking about how, you know, he spoke about, you know, the 3 degrees of Kemetic initiation, you know, and I correlate those with the 3 degrees of, you know, of the Blue Lodge, or, you know, the first 3 degrees of Freemasonry up to a Master Mason degree. And so I just show how these things are very similar, but I'm always coming from a African-centered perspective, an African psycho-spiritual perspective, and everything that I'm talking about within that text.
You know, it's interesting when you mentioned about the rites of passage, because over the summer, doing the Afrocentricity International, or the DEOP conference specifically, was a sister that compared the rites of passage systems that are on the continent and the rites of passage systems that are here in North America. And she was from Louisiana. And when she broke it down into different things that were similar, the one thing that stuck out that she identified, that the rites of passage systems on the continent had a spiritual component to it. But there was only few, and I think the number was one or two, but she said that it was only few rites of passage systems here in North America that had a spiritual component to it. So came up with reasons why, but I just thought that you saying that the need for that, when we're talking about, and even the underutilization of it in the already existing institutions, that isn't being utilized. And again, when I think about, you know, the Bokman and the Haitian Revolution, one of the ceremonies was the ceremony. It wasn't necessarily, I don't think it was an Ifa ceremony, but it was an African ceremony that was going on to prepare them for the war against the Europeans. So again, I guess I'm with you, the importance of it. It's just a question of how do we incorporate it within our different organizational developments or utilize them in the organizations that we already have, which is a interesting thing.
Well, Richard, you said the rites of passage system that we have here. What rites of passage systems do we have here?
Well,
and I'm not talking about individuals doing things maybe in their certain groups in certain cities doing things with youth and trying to kick against a tide. But what, we don't have any rites of passage system here.
I mean, that's true.
Who does she was a diamond. You said we don't have a rites of passage system here, where, like you saying, in the United States, period?
Yes.
Oh, that's absolutely not true.
But go ahead. Go ahead. Throw some light.
So you're saying there are no rights of passage systems in the United States?
Oh, no. That's not what I said.
I'm trying to seek correction. What are you saying?
There are things going on in every city where people are trying to do rites of passage with some of our youth. But I'm talking about a system. For example, they have a school system in this country, and it's for indoctrination. It's a system set up in every city. You have to go through K-12. It's a system. But I'm talking about black folks, don't have a rites of passage system here for our children. We don't.
Do you believe that in Africa that there was a rites of passage system for the entire continent of Africa?
Wait a minute, say that again, Dr. Benson.
Or were there individual groups in their individual location doing their individual rites of passage for their people?
Well, no, I believe just from, I mean, I'm no historian. I'm maybe a student of a lot of the people that we've had on the program. But I know that there was a system set up for us to take our children through rites of passage. Well, those civilizations would have never lasted thousands of years. It was
clear. But you're saying, so systems and then what? How expansive was this system in Africa?
Well, I'm talking about that the children went through, that adults took them through.
Right. I got you. But you're saying that it was a system. And what you said earlier, as far as us here in the United States, is that there's no system, but there are things in every city that people are doing for their children. And so what I'm saying is, I'm asking, what's the difference between people doing their local rites of passage in various cities here and the people doing their local rites of passages in various cities in Africa?
Oh, no. There is no difference in that. But I'm talking about, okay. I thought that Richard was talking about an established system. That's what I was trying to get you to throw some light on.
So I'm asking you, what's the established system in Africa?
Well, I mean, our brothers on the continent have been destroyed just like we have here. Say that again.
What were the established system? What was the established system in Africa?
Well, I don't know what was the established system in Africa that they took our children through. But I know that there was.
Right. And so what I'm saying is that based on what I'm understanding you to mean by an established system, there was not an established system for the continent of Africa. What you had were people within their civilizations and societies that put on their rites of passage programs for their kids. Similar, not exactly like, because the spirituality, the spiritual comprehension and spiritual connection, intentional conscious spiritual connection was different. But what you had, basically what you have here now, which is people in their cities doing their rites of passage programs. You even see that, you know, gang initiation is a rites of passage program. And that is definitely institutionalized and it's systematic. You have organizations like your Saracen Society. You've got the various ELA. Dealing with the Ifa tradition, which is also an institution that's based on a system of longevity throughout the United States. You know, so you do have these very, you got what we're talking about. You got, first of all, Freemasonry that has a youth organization, you know, that it initiates, it's a rites of passage for the younger ones. And so you do have these systems in place. Now, that's the only thing I'm pushing back against is the statement that those systems, they don't exist as a system here in the United States. And what I'm saying is that they exist here as a system by definition, just as they existed as a system on the continent of Africa. It just wasn't one for the entire continent. It was always local.
And I think the only distinction would be made when we look at it on the continent is that those ethnic nations, and I think is important, those ethnic nations that had those rites of passage systems were to govern, was to assist in solving, and you know, I'm using Amos Wilson's language, solving the problems of those nations. We're here, and you're right, it seems that we have groups, but it's not that, and you can say, you know, that there may be, you can, you know, what, extrapolate that they're kind of like nations unto themselves, gangs, is, you know, whether they be Crips, Bloods, or whatever the other names are, they're like nations unto themselves, but they're not, their system would not equal to, say, the Saracet system or the Vodun system as far as the communities that practice those rites of passage processes. And maybe I'm off on saying that, which makes it different than when we look at the continent, where those, as you say, those isolated groups are nations, ethnic nations unto themselves, that put their children through a process which is meant to solve the problem for that nation, which would be different.
So now the Bloods and the Crips, the system that they go through is designed to solve their problems as well. So mm-hmm. I don't want us to mix intention with effectiveness, okay. Right? I don't want us to, you know, say that if the problem is black liberation, you know, we define that as the problem, and then say that what they're doing doesn't solve the problem. You know, what we have to do is understand the problem from their perspective and then see that, yes, the systems that they have developed and that they are a part of are attempts to solve the problem as they see it. It might not be as we see it, and we might say that we should go about it a different way, but it is designed to intentionally designed to solve their problems, whatever those problems are defined as. You know, and so, you know, I'm just kind of stepping back and, you know, without, yeah, I'm just stepping back and looking at it, you know, globally. And you know, it's not fair to say that those systems don't exist now, because they do. And I'm pushing back against that, because if we think that the systems just flat out don't exist, then we're coming at it as if we have to build something from scratch.
I'm just saying this is me saying it. Okay.
And if you see it as systems do exist, and that they might need some fine tuning to maybe understand a greater problem or a more efficient and effective way of approaching solving the problem, and a way to do it without creating more problems, you know, then that's different. That's a whole different approach than the systems don't exist.
I didn't mean the systems don't exist. I'm talking about in the step. Well, put it this way. There are people in every city that's doing what you and Brother Richard stated about trying to take our children through the rites of passage. The large percentage of our people don't get involved in it because of exactly what you were talking about earlier. The conscious and subconscious mind of our people are looking towards white folks and white they're looking towards white knowledge. Everything is based on European understanding. So they might not come to a rites of passage that Brother Richard or Dr. Menzies has given. You'll have some people bringing their children, but you won't get the overwhelming majority of our people doing that. They won't, because the problem exists in the subconscious minds of our people and looking towards white folks and white people as far as having the understanding to guide our people. It's a problem. It's a huge problem.
And you know, Dr. Menzies, is that because that huge problem that alludes to, is that because white supremacy symbol system making is more effective, or is it just that it's more pronounced, meaning that it's that we're so immersed in it that so many people are in it? You had made reference to earlier that in branding or different products that you can just see the symbol and identify what it is as if it was there. Is it because that's their effectiveness in the symbol making, or is it because they have immersed that symbol to where that no matter where you turn, you're engaged in it, and therefore it incorporates us?
Yeah, I definitely would say that it's more the ubiquitous nature of this, of their symbolism. We're existing within their matrix, so to speak, right now. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes, it's all pervasive up to a point. And also we've been trained to look externally, you know, for symbolism. Even, you know, we're trained to look externally for knowledge and insight. And the one place that, you know, that's outside of the jurisdiction is the deepest aspects of our internal being. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if we were learned again, which is what some of the deeply rooted spiritual systems that do exist are designed to get people to go deeper within themselves so that they can tap into that source of internal insight, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. But right now, because we're so externally driven, generally speaking, and our environment is flooded with the symbols that they create for their purposes, you know, we are more likely to be influenced by those than our own. One of the projects that I completed a few years back is I created two decks of African-centered playing cards where I replaced the heart, spades, diamonds, and clubs with African symbols. And I did that because I understand the power of symbolism. You know, the heart, spades, diamonds, and clubs are there for a reason. You know, they all got a meaning behind each one of those. I'm not even talking tarot. I'm just talking about the deck of playing cards itself. And so what I did is I got a deck where I used the Adinkra symbols, and then I got a deck where I used the Vodun Veve. And it's because I want us to be exposed to our symbolism. Even if you can't interpret the symbol off the bat, that's the exposure to it. And what happens is people have a difficult time making that leap from the heart space dominant clubs that they're so used to using the African symbolism that's on that deck of cards. And I watch it happen all the time. You can feel the cognitive struggle that people have trying to, and you know, and one of the Bodun Bebe that I use, it matches up. It's a heart, you know, it's in the shape of a heart, and people still have trouble seeing this African symbolic heart as opposed to the European symbol of a heart that they're so used to. And so it's just because they've been exposed so much to the other symbols that it's going to take some time to get acclimated to our own symbolism, you know, our own spiritual systems, you know, our own way. And, you know, as we all know, you know, we're still on the upstroke, man. We're still trying to climb up out of this stuff. And, you know, on the way up, you know, some of us might climb faster than the others. You know, some of us, you know, might not even try to climb, you know. So it's all kind of us on this path right now.
It's too scene that comes. One is just was filmed on a YouTube, and the other is a movie, in the movie Get Out. And really, I was some professor that, you know, did a talk on it and showed when the psychologist was taking the breath through the thing, and I think it was supposed to be going into the sunken place, and he was dealing with the Du Boisian model of double consciousness. And the more he got into that sunken place, and in my mind was saying, the more he got to his African self in the film, which scene was his expression, the more fear he expressed in that moment. It's like going to, you know, the point that you're making, you know, if I understand you right, the more we, you know, for some of us, the more we go to our African self, the more afraid we are of even identifying with that because of the pervasiveness of our European expression or in immersion, as far as being what safe, and it's really external. It's not necessarily within us, you know. So you have to have some kind of courage, right? Would that be fair to say? You have to have some kind of courage to deal with that inner. The deal with our inner African self.
Yeah, you know, and that path towards embracing your true self, some of the historical path, you know, we've been conditioned to associate it with pain and punishment. And any healthy organism tries to avoid pain and punishment at all costs, unless, of course, they've associated pain with pleasure. Then they do painful things for the joy of it.
Right.
Typically, a healthy individual is trying to avoid pain at all costs. And so that's why psychologically the pursuit of our African selves have often been associated with some type of punishment one way or the other. And this, which is why, you know, we get, you know, a plethora of movies, you know, with us as African people suffering, you know, we got a Birth of a Nation that came through, but it was still within the context of us suffering, you know? So, you know, and those are the movies that's going to win the awards, the Academy Awards and stuff. And those are the ones that's typically going to be funded the most because it reassociates, you know, us as African descendants with some type of pain and some type of punishment. And so when you start trying to embrace and get people to embrace their African self, that avoidance kicks in because, again, they're avoiding the punishment, not necessarily the African stuff, but the punishment that it's been associated with.
That's another a layer to that, because the other one that I seen recently was a brother put a picture of Malcolm on the left and a picture of Marcus on the right and a picture of white Jesus in the middle. And everyone and said, who do you think, I'm sorry, I don't have it right now, but who gives you the most protection? It's something to that effect. Who do you feel would be your, you know, the one that you embrace? Which one do you embrace the most? And two, and this was regardless of age, regardless of gender, they, most of them picked the white Jesus.
Yeah,
most of them picked the white Jesus. Few knew who Malcolm was. Very few knew who Marcus was, but it was just like amazing. And as you know, and we, as we, you know, with what they did with the in the Brown experiment that they did with the dolls, the black dolls, white dolls. But it's just that's the, here is a white Jesus, you know, and when you say that that's what you identify the most. And it doesn't, and I mean, and it was even small. I mean, babies, he asked, and they identified with that. And that's just a symbol. If I'm not mistaken, it's not necessarily that they had any, might've had any knowledge of, some express, you know, why, you know, that they felt it was, but, and he didn't ask, he just would ask the question, which one did you, see the satisfied you the most, and it was that white Jesus. So the power of these symbols, and you know, that's the point I'm based off of what's saying. Yeah, I wonder, Elliot, does anybody, excuse me, go ahead.
I was gonna say the experiment, as you have explained it, to me it's simply just pointing out what people are more exposed to, you know, more exposed to white Jesus as opposed to Marcus Garvey or Malcolm X, you know, and then also that's on one end. And then also, as I was saying earlier, the actual way that you're exposed to these people. So you're exposed to Malcolm X, you know, whose life ends with assassination. Yeah. You get taught about Marcus Garvey, you know, who gets arrested and deported, you know? And so again, you associate the greatness of those two brothers with some type of punishment and pain for their greatness. You know, so again, people are going to be attracted to that because it's just human nature to avoid punishment. You know, you have to make a very intentional move towards getting past that if that's what you're going to do.
Dr. Menzi, let me ask you this question, because you're a clinical psychologist and a doctor of psychology. And I asked this question of the guest we had last week, documentary filmmaker. Jeremiah Kamara, he did some documentaries on the black church. It's going to deal with what you were talking about earlier about symbolism, and especially the use of media to promote symbols or symbolism. When you, and I'll use police killings of men, women, and children in a lot of these cities and small towns, and you see, because I know everybody don't do it, but you see the ones that they show on the television, black folks that are forgiving these white people after horrendous acts have been committed against their family members, whether it's kicking a door open while a young man is eating a bowl of ice cream and watching Netflix, or whether it's a young woman sitting in her home playing video games with her nephew, or like here in Philadelphia, a young man trying to protect himself, being stormed on by a dope addict, drunk, a white folk, white developer who attacked him on the street. And this young man, I think he was a student at Morgan, if I'm not mistaken. And the people forgive these Europeans after these horrendous acts have been committed. Subconsciously, what is that? Explain that to me, that mindset, because I don't think that they realize what it is. They just do it. It's like a Pavlov dog type of reaction. But
right.
from your understanding, what is that?
Yeah, I agree with you, man. That they probably just going through the motions of saying something, and you know, hoping that what they're doing is truly expressing forgiveness. But I even question that they are truly forgiving the person in the real sense of the word. But yeah, I'm with you as far as it being just an automatic reaction, an automatic response. because that's what they're taught to do. You know, if they, especially if they're claiming to be good Christian people, you know, then that's what quote unquote good Christians are supposed to do, is turn the other cheek. It's supposed to, you know, forgive thine enemy, you know. And so I think people are just going through those empty gestures. If there was a way to measure if they were really forgiving in their hearts, I would bet that the majority of people are not actually forgiving in their hearts. And then one other aspect of it, though, is that it might be a fear response. You know, they're in the midst of being traumatized. And so that's why I kind of push back against people who start talking crazy about people's families. Like somebody like Bokum Ja was just killed. You know, people calling his family members coons and stuff.
Okay.
You know, when the sister was just killed, people calling her father or her aunt or somebody, calling them a coon. I'm like, you know, these people are traumatized. And when people are experiencing extreme trauma like that, you know, the responses and the reaction to that aren't necessarily done with a sound mind. You know, and so some people could be scared to death talking about I forgive you. Why? Because they don't want you to come and kill them. You know, ask Bolton's neighbor, you know?
Okay.
And so the people are very aware on a conscious or unconscious level that it's very dangerous to step out and push against, you know, these trained killers who have the green light to take you out. And so in those moments, sometimes it might be survival instinct kicking in, like, yo, peace. Yeah, I know you just did my folks wrong, but peace. You know what I mean? You know, don't think that I'm going to be protesting against you, organizing against you, because I don't want you all to protest or organize against me. So peace. You know, so it could be any of those things, but I definitely push back against people who are quick to throw that coon label on the folks' family in the midst of their mourning, you know, as if somehow, you know, the person throwing that jab knows better, you know, and knows what the family is actually going through, you know.
Okay.
So I take from what you're saying that we need a whole lot more. One, that there is a certain amount of people that are naturally have a natural propensity to their African self. And two, in symbol system making or utilizing old symbols or creating new ones, we need a lot more production of symbol system making that centers us in our own African self.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that sounds, or at least that's something that we can do. Now, I see you said that when you started, because I have three books that you did: the African Lodge, number one, J.A. Rogers, and is that J.A. Rogers J.A. Rogers, and then Dumbing Down, and then Elliot made reference to ones that you've done on the Lodge. What were the titles of those for those who might be listening that might be interested?
Yeah, the most recent publication is Masonic Meditation, and I've got volumes 1, 2, and 3. And it's a collection of my Masonic writings to date, all of which is written from an African-centered perspective, covering various topics. So, like, volume 1 deals with symbols. Volume 2 is dealing with the philosophy. And volume 3 deals with, you know, the practical application. It's something I talk about, which is developing and cultivating the Masonic mind. And so volume 3 is consists of articles that talks about applying meditation, to your life, self-improvement techniques to your life, written in a Masonic tone, but from an African perspective.
Yeah. And I have to jump back to the side on this one, because me and Elliot was making reference about this earlier today. We were looking at and listening to Maria Stewart's address to the Masonic Lodge in 1833. Am I being too presumptuous to say that you're familiar with it?
And you said, who was it again?
Maria Stewart.
No, I'm not.
She did a address in 1833 to the Masonic Lodge, and basically telling men that, you know, and it's interesting, because it's, you know, when we were talking about it, the things she was addressing as far as what we should do as African men if we weren't under, and correct me if I'm wrong, Elliot, if I got this characterization wrong, what we've done under, if we were under our own own realm, we haven't been doing under European, you know, and that is just standing up and for our own self. And that's utilizing the arts and sciences as the tools to demonstrate us standing up as men for our own African, I call it liberation, our own African self as men. She was she made that address in to the Boston. I think that was the Boston Lodge in 1833.
Let me it's 8:34 in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation with the doctor of clinical psychology, spiritual life coach, Dr. Jeff Menzie. We're talking about the African origin of Freemasonry and related topics. You can get involved in this conversation if you choose to by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Dr. Menzie, let me ask this for the time that we have left in the program. The situation that our people face, and especially now, moving forward. I mean, it's been dire for a number of years. It's been dire since we've been here, but we see the way this country's going politically. We see where it's headed. Period, for our people, and it's not positive. Our people have always been in a struggle against white supremacy and white hegemony. What a percentage of our people don't seem to grasp is that white supremacy have been successful to me because white folks have put white supremacy and white hegemony above everything. And when I say above everything, above religion, above social orders, above Greek letter groups, above everything. That's how it's been successful. But if you flip the script, and it goes back to what you were talking about subconscious and conscious behavior. When you flip the script, our people don't put everything about blackness above certain things. They don't put it above religion. They don't put it above social orders. They don't put it above Greek letter organizations. They put those entities above being black. Sometimes being black comes second or third, a third or fourth. And in order to be successful against a struggle against white supremacy, we have to put our being above everything and table some of these other issues. And the reason I'm saying this, Dr. Menzie, and I just want you to answer it any way you see fit. Especially the social orders, because a lot of these heads of white supremacy, whether it's in this country or in Europe, they're members of social orders. And if I'm black and struggling, I might only go but so far against them, because in my mind, they're brethren in my craft. So I'm only going to go but so far. And if you're struggling for the basic life of our people, then our people have to be paramount. We can't put anything above the struggle for our babies and the life of our people. I think what you're doing, trying to enlighten our people in different organizations, whether it's the Masonic Order or other orders, that a lot of these things the origin of these things came from our people are important, because it might shake somebody to understand that the preservation of our people is going to come from us reaching back and reclaiming what's ours. It's important to me, and I'm glad it's important to you, because this is our salvation. What you're doing is a part of reclamation and salvation. I just want you to throw some light on that before you wind things down.
So just so I make sure I'm clear, you're saying that, well, yeah, you're pointing out that in order for us as black people, American Africans, to be successful, you know, black has to be our priority. You know, our own well-being as a collective has to be prioritized and placed above any other affiliations that one may have. And so, yeah, I totally agree with that, that, you know, self-preservation is the key. You know, Dr. Weldon often talked about black self-respect and how, you know, if you don't have black self-respect, then you're vulnerable to everything that white supremacy wants to throw at you.
Okay.
And, you know, sometimes people do try to join organizations in an attempt to assimilate with white folks. But I don't think that that was the motivation at the origin of Prince Hall or African Lodge Freemasonry.
I agree.
It was the contrary.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, just, you know, continuing on in that spirit, I think that over history there have been Prince Hall Masons who have got, you know, stood strong in that tradition, you know, and actually pushed back. And I do believe that that's what's going to be required, whether we're talking about independent schools. You know, we need administrators who can push back, you know, against the white hegemony, against white supremacy, and its multi, you know, faceted approach. And definitely on the individual level. So, you know, there's people who are, you know, not willing to rock the boat, you know, simply because of an affiliation, you know, that's one thing. But if somebody's not rocking the boat because they are truthfully fearful, you know, that's totally understandable. Because, you know, fear is a very powerful thing. And, you know, terrorists, that's their main tool, you know, is to make people afraid, to terrify people.
Yes.
And it's because being in a terrified state, you know, it basically immobilizes you. And if it doesn't immobilize you, it makes you reactionary as opposed to responsive. And, you know, reaction when you touch a hot stove is perfect because you don't have time. You don't want to take time to think about whether or not you should move your hand, you know, but reactionary when it comes to building an institution and making decisions for the longevity institution, that should be responsive. But if we're stuck in a reactionary state because of fear, then we're not likely to be able to put down a strong enough foundation for anything to last.
Okay.
You know?
I understand. Dr. Menzies, before you leave us this evening, give out any information you want, how people can get the books. And in fact, I'm interested in the playing cards. The prices of the cards, how they can get them, everything that you want to give. Go ahead.
Right. So if you, my website is mindonthematter.com. That's mindonthematter.com, /shop, S-H-O-P. And that's how you get to my online bookstore where I sell all my books and all my cards and everything. Social media, it's just DRJEFFMENZISE. So that's at DRJEFFMENZISE. That's going to be Twitter. That's Instagram. And then you can find me on Facebook as The Real Dr. Jeff Menzies. That's all the ways to get at me, man. I'm out there constantly trying to educate through whatever mediums are available. You know, I post everyday information. I post some of the very deep stuff. It just depends. I'm trying to reach as many people as possible on as many different levels as people are.
Okay.
But you can find everything right there at the website.
You said The Real Doctor. So is somebody fake going around or what, Dr. Menzies?
yeah, it may be. I mean, I've seen a Facebook page that I didn't start, you know, so I was like, let me go ahead.
And it had your name on it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it had my name on it. I challenged it, though. I sent it in, you know, to the powers that be, and I think they shut it down.
Okay. All right. And you can get the cards from the site also?
Yeah, yeah. The cards are right there on the website, man. And the cards, there's also a book that comes with the decks of cards. And the book explains the history of playing cards. It explains the different European symbols, you know, from Spain, from Germany, from Italy.
Oh, wow.
And it also explains the culture that the deck that I created comes from. So the Akan culture. Where the Adinkra come from, and then also the Bodun culture, focusing heavily on Benin, and then also deciphering each and every symbol that's placed on the cards. And, you know, I made all the face cards. Every detail of the card I did myself, man. And it was a true labor. I learned a lot making those, especially about the history of playing cards, 52 deck, 52 cards, you know, 52 weeks in a year. I mean, there's just so much symbolism in a deck of cards. It's amazing. And I can't think of a better place to, you know, put our African symbolism. And each African symbol that I place also has a purpose and a reason for being placed. And all of that is explained in each of the books that come with the cards.
Wow. And I mean, I love that part of it because it's a lot of our people that get involved in things that they have no idea what they're involved in. If you ask them, what are you doing? And I gave that example of this day that just passed, Halloween. It turns my stomach when I see our people out there running up and down. And I'm talking about adults. And you ask them, they don't know. They do it because everybody else is doing it. I mean, what kind of, and then their children are following them. It's not the children's fault. And then they'll grow up to be adults doing the same thing. So, yeah, when you said that you put instructions on there about the history of cards and what those symbols mean, that's excellent.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed making those, man. It's probably one of the most difficult things that I've had to do. You know, I mean, measuring and laying out the cards and, you know, I mean, I tried to make it as exact and precise as possible. Created the symbols, all of that, man.
Now, have you, just curious, have you made a games where the people can play or maybe children or even adults can play the card or they can just substitute the deck for the cards that they use when they're playing cards?
Right, right. Yeah, so, you know, any card game, it plays any card game with them. And so other than that, I just, when I'm playing with the kids, these are just matching games.
Okay.
They're using the African symbols in their matching games.
Okay.
But no, I didn't create a specific game for it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Menzie, I want to thank you for being with us, and we're going to tap into you. I ain't going to wait 4 or 5 years next time to bring you on.
Right, anytime, good brother. I appreciate the invitation, y'all.
Yes, and I really enjoy it. And yes, I really enjoyed it, and thank you. You clarified a lot of things, give me a lot to work with as we move forward.
You know. Nice, man. Yeah, thanks again for reaching out, good brothers, and keep up the good work.
We'll talk soon.
Peace.
Take care now. Peace.
We're going to take a brief break, Richard, and we'll be right back. About 15 minutes left in the program, so if somebody want to call up and get involved in the conversation, you can do that by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening.
Time for an Awakening.
With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in 3 states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Greene sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:57. Richard.
Yes, sir.
Interesting conversation.
Yeah. I think it really helps to see how deep this is, you know, to have that when we're dealing with the mind. And I'm glad that he brought up the spiritual component. But the thing of how much work we have to do. And when we're talking about to get us to explore symbols and to be able to get people within the organizations they are in to have the, and I think the discussion about the rites of passage was important to utilize the symbols to truly get at our African self. I think that that's paramount. You know, when we look at, when we talk about the onslaught of the challenge that we have coming in front of us.
Yeah, well, sometimes circumstances drive people to do other things. And the circumstances for our people here in this system that we live under is not going to get any better. It's only going to get worse. We see a lot of the things that have been put in place now, whether it's gentrification in these cities, whether it's cutting out, taking the legs out of the so-called rights that some of our people thought that they had. These things are only going to affect our children in an adverse fashion. Some of the other people that might be of a certain age, it might not affect them. They might not see those effects, but the children definitely will, and the children's children, unless we do something yes. about it. We can't stay on the sidelines. We can't, and I'm glad that Dr. Menzi said on the program that in order for us to be sincere about this fight, that we're going to have to table all of those things that we hold dear and understand that it's us, it's all we have. Mm-hmm. We can't say I got my Jesus and I got this, that, and the other. It's us that's all we have. We have to put everything ahead of this struggle that we're dealing with. We have to put our people as paramount, and especially our children. That's where the fight is. Richard, if you got time, because the call just about, you want to take a call too?
Oh, I'm gonna have to go, but go ahead.
Yeah, let's go to 267. 267?
Yes, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Good, sir. I have to have talked to Dr. Jeff Menzi. He has some interesting things that he had to say. Can you hear me?
Yes. I think your radio is up in the background. If you could turn that down just a little bit.
So I'm on two lines. I'm gonna cut it off.
Okay.
Is that better?
Yes.
I was on the 776 line.
Okay.
And he was interesting because, how are you, Richard, by the way?
I'm good.
Good. He was interesting, by the way, because Elijah Muhammad, people don't know, was a third-degree Mason. He was a master Mason. And he didn't always encourage his followers to be that, but he didn't disagree with what he was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a conscious Mason who had Masons in the temple who came, and he knew how we were able to survive with that. And he was in Sandersville, Georgia. And the people of that era, they can, who would go back and understand their culture, their native land, and their people, would add to what they knew to be in a group like that. The Masons were very valuable, just like the Eastern Stars. Richard Allen was one, Absalom Jones. And I think even in being in the fraternal order, which we have programs for youth, which is called God Right and Kappa League, we mentor youth at a young age. And I think that people have a misunderstanding about a fraternal order, a Mason and the Eastern Star. Now, there are some people who are in those orders who do things that are out of order, and people equate that with what they're doing in the organizations. You have good, bad, and ugly in all of those organizations. And you look back, Kings of Mason, Cecil B. Moore, a whole lot of people. And I don't even think in their consciousness that they were more culturally connected to the motherland. And I think as we have evolved, I think as of now, we still don't do it. Like, I had some brothers who I knew who went to Morehouse, and I'm a Kappa from Lincoln University. And their thing was, well, Tim, why do you use, same thing with Gil Scott Heron, say when he was at Lincoln, why do you use the Greek letters? Well, that's because of being stripped of our mother of tongues. But a friend of mine with some other friends wanted to start a fraternal order at Morehouse. He wanted to use African symbols and African language. And I said, that was good. It never got off the ground. That's unfortunate. But we have to learn to make these transitions in these organizations while we're still together, because they could be used in a way of bringing us together. And it's up to the people that are in the organizations to push our culture, our people, our folks, our goals, politically, educationally, and socially. Now, how far we get with that, I can't tell you. But the individuals who I know and who I hook up with are part of a reality think tank of Thinking Black. Unfortunately, you have those who are in there that make us look what we do as child's play. And that's a shame. Okay. Just like any other organization.
Well, listen, I thank you for your input and insight on some of the things. I think that what you're expressing is something similar to what Dr. Menzies said, you know, the challenges that he faces when he tries to bring some of these things to the fore. So, listen, I'm glad for your input.
Oh, yeah. And I know from my folks in the 30s and in the early 1900s that's how they survived. My great-grandmother, her siblings, my great-uncles, they had the church, the Masonry, and the Eastern Stars. And they were able to do things. They helped each other. Well, back then, black people did more for each other back then than now today. And they were able to do things. Now, the thing is, there's difference between a white Mason and a black Mason. The Prince Hall Masons are black men. The Eastern Stars are black women. Now, a white Mason doesn't have the same goal that a black Mason does. His thing is white supremacy. You look at Gerald Massey, gives the African in America all his props. He talks about the pyramids, Nile Valley civilization, and Godfrey Higgins. They have some Masons are not going to do that. These two will give them what we actually have done as black people. Now, amongst themselves, I'm pretty sure they're not pushing pro-black. Now, in the Masonry, the Eastern Stars, and fraternal orders, and the sororities, it's up to us that when we're together to do that. And that's in almost any institution with us, Elliot. We don't think it's always appropriate to have black or race first. Our things that we want to integrate. But when you integrate, you're disintegrating. You're supposed to bring, that's the thing of America, keeping yourself who you are and being black. That's the thing, is starting off one way and ending up another way. That has always been our challenge. And some of us get there, some of us don't. And once we get there, do we help each other out? That is always a challenge for us.
I agree. I think Richard expressed some of that when we were talking earlier, because you know, he was talking about some of the things that he had done in reference to some of the organizations early on. So
I heard him. I was on the other line, though. I guess he didn't recognize the number. Mm-hmm. All things is good. You brothers are working out. I see that, and you're still doing the work, and that's good.
Thank you for your call, brother.
All right.
Peace. All right. Take care.
Indeed.
Richard, look like we came to the conclusion of another program before we leave this evening. I want to give the lineup Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. That's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Afterwards, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones from 1 to 3 on Time for an Awakening Media. From 6 to 8, Brother Jihad Ahmed and Acres of Diamonds from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. It's the first Monday in the month, so it's Conversation Reparations, which is tomorrow, 9 to 10. On Time for an Awakening Media, and then afterwards, Warren Valentine's Night Talk podcast, which is Mondays through Fridays, 10 to 12 a.m. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Thursday, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for An Awakening Media. And on Fridays, Time for An Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for An Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school. If we know all we say we know about the problem. To save the children.